Blog Talk Radio.
I release all disappointment from my mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional body. 'Cause I know that spirit guides me and love lives inside me. That's why today I take life as it comes.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome again to Higher Consciousness. I am so honored to have this opportunity to connect with you on this very special evening, the evening of the second inauguration of President Barack Obama. My name is Professor Jamila Franklin, and I am the host and creator of the show Higher Consciousness. And as I always state during my show, I always give people background information for the new listeners. Currently, I teach psychology at colleges. I have a private counseling practice, and I am a certified Reiki master and an energy medicine practitioner. And I'm also a certified metaphysician, life coach, author, and aromatherapist in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area, more specifically in the Stone Mountain area. Now, the reason for my developing the show is I wanted to have a forum for discussions about metaphysics, spirituality, holistic psychotherapy, and holistic health. I also wanted to talk about holistic nutrition, divine relationships, the law of attraction, and we will also have shows that deal with divine prosperity and universal laws. And we occasionally have guests on the show, and tonight I have the honor and privilege of having Reverend Paul Banks, who was very, very involved in the civil rights movement. And he's a neighbor of mine, and I asked him 2 days ago to be a guest, and I said this will be a very appropriate show since I'm talking about the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, whom he knew personally. So, and Higher Consciousness is now a two-hour show that will allow listeners to delve into topics at a higher vibrational level. And the only ground rule is that everyone gives respect when expressing opinions. And this rule automatically raises your vibrational level so that you can receive respect as well. So again, tonight's topic is celebrating Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And additionally, I will give some brief information about this being the 50th year of the famous March on Washington led by Dr. King on August 28, 1963. I will give more detailed information in August about that famous march. If you want to join in the discussion this evening, please feel free to call 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. And for those of you who want to use the internet, type in http://tobtr.com/s/42409111. Again, the link is http://tobtr.com/s/42409111. 1-800-273-0911. And internet users, you will still have to call 1-818-572-8023 and press 1 to join the discussion. And only one call at a time. Again, this is Higher Consciousness, and I am Professor Jamila Franklin. And the purpose of the show is to connect you on a heart-to-heart and soul-to-soul level. This is not a show for intellectual debates. Instead, this show is dedicated to those who truly want to learn and grow spiritually and to heal. Last week, we discussed Reiki, a powerful healing energy, and I am a doubly attuned Reiki master, so I gave a lot of information about the background of Reiki. In addition to that, what I did is I had a group meditation, which was leading to a spiritual healing for people. And I've gotten feedback that people could really feel the energy that was being transmitted during the meditation, because I was sending Reiki energy out to people to help heal you on all levels, on the physical, emotional, mental, and etheric levels. And last week we had 11 listeners who listened via their computers, and we have 4 live callers, and we've had 750 downloads, which means over 750 people have downloaded last week's program. So I am so very thankful to each of you. And since October 22nd, 2012, when I first started the show, we have now had over 11,587 listens, which includes the live calls. And we've had over 11,000 people tune in only 3 months, and so this is phenomenal. But it's only because of you, the listening audience, and I'm so thankful and so appreciative to each and every one of you. And also remember, if you can't join us live, go to the website, and you can hear all of the shows which are archived. Now, even though we may live a divine life and know who we are and know about the I Am presence within us, we sometimes still experience fear, which is false evidence appearing real, which causes us to remain in the matrix, which is controlled thinking, due to not understanding the law of attraction. And we talked about the Mayan prophecy over 5 weeks ago with Kaya Aman, my Reiki master, who was the guest on the show. And so since December 21st, the planet has experienced a different kind of vibration, and that vibration is one of universal love. So what that basically means is that people are having to do less to experience more. You are now able to think a thought, and things are happening faster, at a faster rate. And it's my hope that people are thinking higher vibrational thoughts, that people are thinking thoughts of love and harmony, because if you think thoughts of fear, which is false evidence appearing real, thoughts of greed, thoughts of hate, confusion, discord, and chaos, and the like, that will show up in your life as well, and it's, those things are happening faster. So the purpose of this show is to have you find out more about what's going on the planet energetically, and to read and to investigate everything that we talk about here on the show, so that you can learn more, or if you already have this information, that you can take it to the next level. So as I said, the controlling energy now on the planet is universal love, which accelerates your energy. Tonight's topic, celebration of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is going to be discussed in detail. After I selected this topic, I remembered that my neighbors, Mrs. Cynthia and Reverend Paul Banks, are originally from Alabama, which is the birthplace of the historic bus boycott with Miss Rosa Parks, which had Dr. King at the helm. And I also remembered then that Reverend Banks was involved with the Civil Rights Movement. So I invited Reverend Banks to be tonight's guest, and he accepted. So he would join us at 7:30 p.m. And tonight I would like to again acknowledge the second inauguration of our 44th president, President Barack Hussein Obama. And it was a very, very moving event that I watched today. I normally don't watch television, but I decided that I wanted to watch because this was the second inauguration of President Barack Obama. And also today is the day that the country celebrates Dr. King's birthday, even though his official birthday is on January the 15th. But to keep it uniform, it's now nationally celebrated on the third Monday in January. And as I watched the swearing-in ceremony, I heard Dr. King's speeches in my head, and his dream has almost been realized. As a young child in Memphis, Tennessee in the 60s, I never thought I would see a black president of this country. I never thought that. And most people who are listening never thought that. So now to have a black president for a second term is something that no one could have predicted. And we still have injustices that have to be overcome, but I believe we are well on the way of empowerment for all people. And on August 28th of this year, we will celebrate, as I mentioned before, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, a march by poor people, which was spearheaded by A. Philip Randolph. And Dr. King was the keynote speaker, and a group of people came together from all over the country, black and white, to talk about racial inequality and injustices. And that was, and they met in Washington, D.C., in front of the monument. So now what I wanted to do is give some information about Dr. King, his bio. Now, some information that I pulled off from the website, an online website. Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January the 15th in 1929, and he died on April 4th, 1968. And this is a fact that very few people know. He was born Michael Luther King Jr., but later it had his name changed to Martin. His grandfather began the family's long tenure as pastors of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. And his grandfather served as the pastor from 1914 to 1931. And then his father served from 1931 until his father's death. And from 1960 until his death in 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King acted as co-pastor. Now, Martin Luther King attended segregated public schools in Georgia, and he graduated from high school at the age of 15, which was just awesome and phenomenal. And he received the BA degree in 1948 from Morehouse College, which is a distinguished African-American institute in Atlanta, from which both his father and grandfather had graduated. So this was a tradition going to Morehouse, because his grandfather and his father graduated from Morehouse. After 3 years of theological study at Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, where he was elected president of a predominantly white senior class, he was awarded the B.D. degree in 1951. And with a fellowship that he won at Crozer, Martin Luther enrolled in graduate studies at Boston University, completing his residence for the doctorate in 1953, and he received his degree in 1955. And so it was in Boston that he met and married Coretta Scott, a young woman of uncommon intellectual and artistic attainments, because she was attending school in Boston as well. And during their marriage, they had two sons and two daughters. So in 1954, Martin Luther King became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And he was always a strong worker for civil rights for African Americans. And by this time, he was a member of the executive committee of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is the NAACP. And that was the leading organization of its kind in the nation. And he was ready then, early in December 1955, to accept the leadership of the first great African-American nonviolent demonstration of contemporary times in the United States. And the bus boycott described by Gunner John in his presentation speech in honor of the laureate. Now, even though Dr. King is remembered for the bus boycott, that movement has started way before he came on board. It was a well-planned-out movement. It wasn't that Rosa Parks just decided that day to sit on the bus, even though that's the folklore and myth that has been circulated around. The NAACP had thought about it for at least a year and a half before that happened in 1955. So, but Dr. King was the emerging charismatic minister of the time, and so what they decided was to have him be the leader of the movement. So I just wanted to let people know that he did not he did not spearhead the movement. The NAACP had thought about this way before it took place. Now, the boycott lasted 382 days, and on December 21st, 1956, after the Supreme Court of the United States had declared unconstitutional the laws requiring segregation on buses, African Americans and whites rode the buses as equals. And during those days of boycott, King was arrested. His home was bombed. He was subjected to personal abuse. But at the same time, he emerged as an African American leader of the first rank. And our guest this evening, Reverend Banks, was very, very instrumental in assisting the people who were jailed at the time, because he was the bondsman who bailed out the civil rights activists. And his story is something that you have never heard before. And now, tonight, he will get a chance to talk about what happened behind the scenes to make the movement such a powerful movement. In 1957, Dr. King was elected president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And this was an organization formed to provide new leadership for the new burgeoning civil rights movement. Because at the time, the NAACP was being perceived by the younger people as one that was still, that was a little too conservative. So the new movement, SCLC, which was started by Dr. King and some more of his contemporaries, decided that they wanted to take the movement to another level. The ideals for this organization he took from Christianity, and its operational techniques in terms of nonviolence, he got from Gandhi, because Dr. King studied Gandhi, and he was very, very impressed with Gandhi's nonviolent approach. When Gandhi protested the segregation and the racism in South Africa against the East Indians who were living in South Africa. So In the 11-year period from 1957 and 1968, Dr. King traveled over 6 million miles and spoke over 2,500 times, appearing wherever there was injustice, wherever there was protest, and wherever he saw the need to advocate for justice. Meanwhile, he wrote 5 books as well as numerous articles. And in these years, he led a massive protest in Birmingham, Alabama, that caught the attention of the entire world, providing what he called a coalition of conscience. And all of this inspired his letter from a Birmingham jail, which is a manifesto of the African American Revolution. He planned the drives in Alabama for the registration of African Americans as voters. Dr. King directed the peaceful march on Washington on August 28, 1963, before 250,000 people, to whom he delivered his address, "I Have a Dream." Dr. King conferred with President John F. Kennedy and campaigned for Lyndon B. Johnson. Dr. King was arrested approximately 20 times and assaulted at least 4 times. Dr. King was awarded 5 honorary degrees and was named Man of the Year by Time magazine in 1963. And he became not only the symbolic leader of American blacks, but also a world-renowned figure. And at the age of 35, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the youngest man to have received the Nobel Peace Prize. And when he was notified of his selection, he announced that he would turn over the prize money of $54,000 $54,123 to the furtherance of the civil rights movement. And this is the caliber of man that he was. And on the eve of April 4th, 1968, while standing on the balcony of his motel room in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was to lead a protest march in sympathy with striking garbage workers of that city, he was assassinated. This father of 4, 2 sons and 2 daughters, was survived by his wife, Coretta Scott King, both his parents, siblings, and other relatives. And I got this information off the website, the Nobel Peace Prize website. I have the honor and the privilege, as I said before, of having Reverend Banks, my neighbor, as my guest this evening. He was very, very important and instrumental in the success of the movement during the time that people were jailed, because it was he who was bailing people out, young college students and older people. It was his law firm that was very instrumental in making sure that they were not incarcerated indefinitely. So he is going to join us at 7:30 this evening. And before he joins us, I just want to talk very briefly about what happened in Memphis. I am originally from Memphis, Tennessee, and I remember very, very clearly what happened prior to Dr. King's death. Because on the eve of his death, the day before he died on April 3rd, he gave his now world-famous speech about, "I may not be there, I will meet you later on the mountaintop," his mountaintop speech. And I was a young child, and I remember standing outside of the church because I wasn't supposed to be where I was, but I was far from my home, but I knew that he was going to be there. My mom didn't like to know that I was at the church, and I knew if she had known I had gone there, I would be in trouble. So I knew And I had told her that I was at a friend's house. So I decided not to go inside the church because I knew that the church was locked. The doors were locked. And if I had gotten locked inside the church and not made it home, by the time the street lights came on, that's what used to happen when I was growing up. You had to be home. By the time those street lights were on, if you weren't home, you were in serious trouble. So I had to be home by the time the street lights were on. So I decided to stay outside, and I could hear the speech because they had microphones, these bullhorns on the side of the church that were broadcasting the speech on the outside. So the church was overflowing with people. And then there were people like myself on the outside, and I was one of the younger people sitting on the outside listening to his speech. And I remember hearing the words that I now see in the vintage footage on television. And I said, wow, I was a part of history. And I remembered at that time feeling so passionate about what my life purpose was going to become. I felt that I was going to commit myself to human service in some capacity. Primarily, I thought about teaching, but I knew that I wanted to make a difference. I knew that I wanted to empower people after listening to his speech. I knew that I was forever changed after hearing his speech, and I would never forget that day, that evening, and how I felt walking back to my home, feeling so empowered and feeling so enthusiastic and just feeling like I could take everything on in terms of the world. He was such a passionate and charismatic speaker. He made you believe in the dream, which was that one day little black boys and little white boys and little white girls and little black girls would join hands together. He made you believe in that, even though I was in Memphis, Tennessee, and the South was still segregated. Even though the laws had been struck down, it was still segregated. And the signs were not up, the colored signs and whatever. They were long gone, but it was still segregated. But he gave you hope. And the fervor in his voice and the confidence in his tone made you visualize and see the world that he could see that was not present. You could envision that world. So now, having had the opportunity to have heard that speech in person, I'm so thankful that I had that opportunity, and I'm so thankful that I chose to go to listen to the speech, even though I had second thoughts at one time about it. I'm just very, very thankful that I decided to listen to my inner voice and to hear the speech from a person who would the next day no longer be on this planet. So I'm just very, very thankful. And that's one of the things about the show that I would like for people to always know. Always listen to your inner voice. Always listen to that God presence within, because it's always correct. And it was speaking to me very loudly and clearly, and it overrode my fear of my mom finding out that I wasn't at home. It overrode my fear of the punishment that I may have received due to my not being home. It overrode that fear. And she never found out until I was an adult that I was not home. So I'm glad that I listened to that inner voice of wisdom, because I would have regretted not having gone there. I would have regretted not having had the opportunity to have heard him in person, even though I did not physically see him in person. But thus, hearing his voice was the next best thing, and I'm forever thankful for that opportunity. And for those of you who would like to call in, please call in. The number is 1-818-572-8023. and press 1 if you would like to join in on the discussion. Again, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. And as I said before, Reverend Banks, who was very involved with the Civil Rights Movement, as an attorney, will join us after this commercial.
This is Professor Jamila Franklin, CEO and President of Oyende Enterprises, a holistic wellness company. We provide dynamic certified Reiki and energy medicine classes and trainings, certified aromatherapy courses, metaphysics courses, life coaching sessions, and private holistic counseling sessions. For more information, call 770-808-8051 or go to our website at www.oyendeenterprises.com. That is spelled OYINDEENTERPRISES.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back. This is Professor Jamila Franklin. This is Higher Consciousness. And tonight we're talking about Dr. King and his legacy and celebrating this wonderful icon. And my wonderful guest is Reverend Attorney Paul Banks, who is my neighbor here in Stone Mountain. Good evening, Reverend Banks. How are you?
Good evening. I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing extremely well, and I am so honored to have you on the show. And I know Reverend Banks has another commitment, so he may have to leave at the top of the hour at 8 o'clock. But I wanted to get him in and to share his experiences with everyone for as long as he can. And feel free to call in. As I said, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. So thank you for sharing your time with us this evening. So I just would like to have you give us some information about your experiences as the Civil Rights Bells Bondsman in Alabama, and just share with us all of the information about your experiences.
Thank you. First, let me say that I have cleared my 8 o'clock commitment so I can stay with you as long as I can be of service to you.
Oh, wonderful.
Always happy and pleased when I have this opportunity, more specifically, when things have been done in a fashion that is more than just have words behind them, but it educates us. I can recall early in my life, I made a speech, and in that speech to the college group, at the end, I challenged them on admitting how little you know about the things you think you know and seek a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Dr. King, his life. It was like a teaching because so very often we get things that we don't get factual. And there was good facts that you were talking that would teach us for a long time to respect the man. Now, I want to narrow down some things for you this evening.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. In the movements, as we call them, we usually get a broad sense of what is happening or what has happened. We hear about the bombing and we hear about the marches, et cetera, but not the details, because those things didn't just happen.
Right.
And the success, to a great degree, not totally, as relates to the Birmingham incident and other cities, were when folks were jailed. And it seemed to me that in Birmingham, as we look at the other cities throughout the country, there was more people confined and jailed than any other place in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that respect, those persons who were jailed had to be released at some point. For example, if there were marches, and there were many, the people gladly participated. So you wonder how in the world can you find people that want to go to jail? Well, that's because of the inspiration and the leadership of the late Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
But when they got into jail, there were things that those folk who committed themselves to participate had to be aware of. You go to jail, and you may be in jail 3 days. Now, here, people who've never been to jail, more or less thinking they might be in jail 3 days, but at some point, I got to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And the Birmingham City Police Department and the jail system required that you make or you present a bond. The people arrested were charged with violating some city laws. More specifically, they were jailed for, number one, marching without a permit.
Mm.
Now, prior to these days, we could go downtown and we might decide we want to march because they would have a bright light someplace or march for other reasons. But specifically now, they're saying you're marching without a permit. Prior to going out to march, there were arrangements made in the church where Dr. King and others were appearing in order that everybody know what's happening. Though when you get in jail, you got to place a bond. At first, it was not difficult. The bonding companies at that time didn't mind making one or two bonds because when the bond was made, your funds were tied up. Money each time a bond was made for you appear in court if you were arrested for marching without a permit, disobeying a police officer, or other reasons why you were being arrested. And there were bonds made for each of those charges.
Wow.
Now, if you're in jail, then get me out or stay in jail for 3 days. At first, as I said, it wasn't difficult, but as the time passed, the bond and company's money was determined but were depleted because when you get in jail, you couldn't get out, so each time you post a bond for a person, your money is tied up in the city.
Mm.
So unless you were a very, very, very large company, your money would be tied up until adjudication is made of the charges that I just told you about. So as time passed, people were being jailed. The other bonding companies then stopped making bonds for those persons being charged with the marches. I had earlier formed in my operations a bonding company. And in forming this bonding company, for the lawyers, we were trying to find easy ways of making bonds for our people there because the blacks were not able to get bonds too fast. And we, in turn, having formed my company, were asked by the people there in Birmingham to make the bonds. But it wasn't too long before I was completely out of money. Now, the city allowed me to use as a part of my security my home. So I used my home as security, and consequently, we could make some more bonds. But I think it should be well known here how Dr. King and SCLC got involved in Birmingham. It's very important. In Birmingham, like in other cities in the South and over the country, there were local organizations who spearheaded the beginning of the concerns that they were fighting in those areas, and we were fighting with discrimination on the trolley cars and going to lunch counters and going to the movie, et cetera, et cetera. And we met as a group. Our group in Birmingham was called the Alabama Christian Human Rights Organization. All organizations, like in Montgomery, they had the Montgomery Improvement Association. Other cities had their local groups. But we were affiliates of SCLC. So at this particular time, we were getting completely just tied up with the movement activities. We weren't getting too far. So then we invited Dr. King and SCLC to come into Birmingham to help us in this fast movement we were making for the discrimination we were experiencing in Birmingham. And he came. And that's how they got directly involved with us. Now, there are so many other things that we could talk about, but some things that are very amazing is, as I told you earlier, my company had gotten to the point where we were completely out of money after having even put my home in, and also continue to make the bonds. It was at a point where in the jail of people began to slow down. So Dr. King and his influence and his SCLC and some other groups in the north, south, east, and west one day called me and told me to the bank that you have now $200,000 to make bonds for.
Wow.
And to this very day, I don't know where that money came from, but we used it. Now, when Dr. King was jailed in Birmingham, while being confined to jail, a group of white clergymen put out a statement about him and the organization that he represented. And in that response came the famous letter from the Birmingham jail. And I suggest that anybody want to get the true picture, the real involvement from his mouth in regards to how he got involved there and about other things about him and in the movement activities that he carried out, I suggest go to the library and get Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail. And in that letter, he tells you how he got there. He wasn't telling you. He was telling those clergymen, and his letter was in response to their statements regarding his participation in the movement activities in Birmingham. They began to call him an outsider coming into Birmingham, creating these problems in this movement. And in a sense, suggestion that he almost leave. But he let it be known why he was there. He let me know in his letter that it was a job, like to him, a movement that he carried out. Now, back to the Barnum people. When they were jailed, at first few days, they would allow those persons within jail to come to court, and when they go to court, fines, besides the bond fee, had been put up. But they couldn't pay the fine because many of them didn't have the money, and many of those folks who were jailed, in effect, at first, it was foreign to them. So in order that they not pay fines, on the bonds, through the legal procedure and strategy, we put at the bottom of each bond that we made, and incidentally, we made 1,400 appearance bonds.
Wow, 1,400 bonds?
1,400.
Wow.
And we put at the bottom of each of those bonds a jury trial demanded.
Mm.
That was the legal process we carried out in order that if you went to court, anybody, for the charges levied against them in the movement, that we want to be heard by a jury.
Mm.
Now, it was not the procedure ever in the past for a jury trial for those kind of charges. However, in accepting the fact that we were asking for a jury trial for each of the persons jailed in the Birmingham jail for the so-called movement or the marches and the charges levied against them, we wanted a jury trial.
Wow.
Therefore, when the bonds were appealed to the next court, they had to take that same bond and, in turn, have a jury trial. Well, in the upper court, they had jury, but if you had looked at 1,400 cases piling your dockets for the next 20 years or most, it's going to clog up everything. So the cases never came to court.
Mm.
Now, while the cases were being held in court, before we put this trial by jury, we would go to court, treated very badly, some of our homes were threatened, mine was threatened. I had been doing a television show, and I got a call, or a television station got a call telling them if they put me on, I was called a Northern, the N-word, station. Those things didn't bother, well, it did bother, but I'm telling you what we were going through. Now, those cases, back to the bonding, those cases that were pending in the court was confused in the court, and just for an incident pertaining to what the people were going through with, many of the people that were jailed, you couldn't find them.
Hmm.
And when the cases would come up, I, along with my associates, were in a bind because when the cases come up, if you don't appear in court, then that's a forfeit. Then the court could make you pay for the person not coming.
Mm-hmm.
That created problems. Another thing that we had when we were, these people who got involved into the court activities gave fake names, and we used to go to court and call them by the names that they had given us at the meetings to go to court, but when they were arrested for marching, and all what the police would do, break up the march and put you on a wagon, take you to court where you get their names. And many of the folk who gave their name one time at the church where we met to prepare for the march, when the police picked them up and put them into the wagon for court, for jail rather, they give a different name. Hmm. And when we get ready to go and get them out of jail, we had the name given to us at the meeting, and we go to jail and ask for that particular person by the name we had at the meeting. They don't have that person.
Wow.
Another problem. I was trying to tell you what the people were glad they wanted to. They weren't trying to get away. It was their desire to participate. It was their desire to do something. And they were not afraid. They were not violent. That was nonviolent activity. So now we have problems. We have people whose parents looking to get their folk out of jail. We don't have the correct name. So we go to jail. We call them by the name that they gave the jailer. And on one occasion, I had 15 names to get out. And when we got there, we got out three of the people whose names were not on our list. They should get everybody. So the jailer asked me, what about those N-words, again describing us, that you didn't get? So then we said, give us all of them.
Hmm.
And in this particular case, when they picked up the people to jail them, there were several people standing on the curbs watching the activities, and the police just grabbed them and put them in jail too.
Wow.
They were not marching. So when we got there on this particular case, to get those out, these persons who were not marching, we didn't call their names. So then one of the jailers asked me, said, what about those guys back there raising all that sand? Don't you want them too? They're marchers. So I said, let me have those guys too. And when those fellows who were not even in the march came out of jail with us and went down to process the toll proceedings, they made a statement, said to me, Mr. Banks, we were not in the march, but you will hear from us. And that night, that group of guys who were not at all concerned about the demonstrations began to throw cocktail balls, and every cab driver that would come through of non-black description, they would fight him and run him away. So that created a problem that we had to deal with. It seems that in this tour activity that I participated in, and in the bonding aspects of it, the thing that really got to my heart was on one occasion they prepared for some young children to participate, and we had almost a bus full of young children who were in school. When I say young, I'm talking about elementary school kids that were participating in a march, and they drove a school bus up and picked up all the children by name and some by name, just put them on the bus and carried them to the city jail. And the most disturbing thing that even made me cry was when they carried those children there unorganized, no protection, nothing. And really, as far as the jail is concerned, very little observation of their activities. They couldn't put them inside the jail because it was almost a busload. And when they went then and couldn't put them in the jail, they put them out on the jail's property that was encaged by wire, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And it rained.
Oh, my gosh.
And the children were out in the rain. These are the things that I can tell more about. Then because they couldn't put them inside, they put them on a bus and carried them to the state fairgrounds, where they have the state fairs in the fall of the year, and housed them into a place there and made an announcement on the radio that all parents who wanted their children who had participated in the march could come down and get their children. So they did not officially charge the children with failing to obey the normal thing that they were charging the other people with.
Oh, my God.
Another thing that was very, it's never been told, I don't think, and why I'm taking this time, and this is the first time, a detailed thing like I'm doing now, was on one occasion we went to court. We had about, I can't remember the number, it was in excess of 15, I know. And the court procedure was traced to take care of those persons who were charged with other cases not involved with the movement, and then call those cases that were identified as movement cases. And in that, at that time, rather, they were beginning to call many of the participants who were highly disordered. And in the past, when the house set up, they almost would stop talking. But this group, for some reason, were very, very highly motivated, talking, and the judge asked for silence and told me to get them. I couldn't stop them, but they were having fun. And the judge, rather a lawyer friend by the name of Adams, who became incidentally the first Supreme Court of Alabama judge, black fellow I'm talking about, was trying one of our cases. And while he was trying the case, in the midst of the case, the judge stopped for a moment and was trying to get more order. And he fell back in his seat. And they later announced him dead.
Mm,
at that
wow.
time, we all, they had to clear the courthouse. They cleared the room. We went outside in the hall. And formed a line along the corridors. And we prayed. And Dr. King's brother, who also was a preacher, offered the prayer, and Reverend Shelleyworth, a few others were there at this occasion. You never heard that before. And maybe The other thing is most very, somebody might want to ask me a few questions. I don't want to take up too much of time talking myself. But one incident that I witnessed in these operations were that at the time that Dr. King was being released from jail. Now, he could have been out. He chose to remain in jail for a duration of time that they allow before your case is adjudicated guilty. And when he came, they were trying to get the time. And they had called my office and asked what time was he going to be released. But I couldn't tell them because the jail wouldn't tell me when to come and get him. At that time, I was surrounded with the newspapers and the press and all the stuff that goes with it. And each time I would leave the office, they would follow me thinking I was going to get him. And finally, I did go to the jail to get him. And we were surrounded with news people from England and everywhere. And The most amazing thing was, now those folks could not go into the jail. The jail was small. But as we called for him to come out, And as he was coming out, after the bond had been posted and everything, and as he came out of the jail to come to the door that they unlocked for him to come out, he and Dr. Abernathy, as he got to the door and spoke, of course, to me and everybody, he said to the jailers, "I want to thank you for the way you treated me while in your jail."
Hmm.
And those men were almost speechless.
Wow.
As were the men, the jail people, as were the court people, rather, when the judge died there, every policeman, everybody in the court stood still, and the policemen took off their hats and put them to their chest as we prayed. And you get a feeling that God was there. I'm a preacher now. You get a feeling these people now are being touched. And I can give you many other incidents like that in the bonding process that we encountered. The most specific why I say this, what those people went through, I'm talking about those demonstrators, those freshers who went to jail not knowing what was going to happen, but went there wild because it was nonviolent. And we only had one violent thing that I can know of. And that was when I said those men who we got out that were not a part of the demonstration who came out and joined in that violent-like way. But in general, the bonding process was very important because that allowed the procedure to follow in an arranged-like order. Although behind the scenes, there were problems that you'll never hear of. And perhaps prior to my coming with you, they would have heard of, because I haven't even detailed this as much as I've done now. Now I'm going to stop talking. Maybe there might be some questions or some more things might come
up.
Yeah,
I'm just speechless. But I'm going to have a short commercial break, and then we're going to return after this commercial break and open up the phone lines.
Are you stressed, tired, need to relax? Peace Be Still, a natural holistic aromatherapy blend, is your answer. My name is Jacqueline Scott, and I have been a faithful user for years. For more information and to purchase Peace Be Still, a wonderful blend for the entire family, go to Amazon.com or call 770-808-8051 today.
Welcome back. This is Higher Consciousness, and I am Professor Jamila Franklin. And tonight's show is celebrating Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I am so privileged and honored to have as my guest my neighbor and wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person, civil rights activist, Reverend Paul Banks, who is also an attorney who was very, very involved with the civil rights movement. He was the primary bonds person for the people who were jailed, and he is sharing this evening with us a history that has never been publicly known. And in our discussions, because, as I said, he is my neighbor, both he and his lovely wife, I've gone to many events at their home, and I just love listening to him talk about the movement. And I decided to have him as a guest 2 days ago. I said it would be very befitting to have him as a guest to talk about his experiences. Particularly, he talks about experiences that are not widely known. And he's talking about things that happened behind the scenes to enable the civil rights movement to be as effective as it was. So please feel free to join us. The number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. Again, the number is 1-818-572-8023 and press 1. And while we're waiting for people to press 1, Reverend Banks, please finish sharing with us. I think what usually happens when people don't call in, they tell me later on, Jamila, I was so interested and mesmerized by the conversation that I didn't want to stop and ask any questions. So, and I see people on the board, so it's not that people are not listening. I think that they just are so interested in what you have to say. So please feel free to continue.
On one occasion, I, along with two other attorneys, were asked to come to Selma, Alabama, to make some bonds. Now, I wasn't privileged in my bond operation to make bonds outside of the city of Birmingham. And to do this, we had gotten permission from the courts there that my security would carry over into any bonds that I made. And to get the picture, one of the attorneys was white. And we drove to Selma, and in going to Selma, there were two cars. And I don't have to describe the composition of the two cars with three people in them, two and one.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got into town, the white attorney was very strong at first, but when he got there, he was somewhat nervous because our cars were surrounded by people who were resenting having the power to bond some of the people out on a license in that city. But it wasn't, it was more or less a nervous affair as far as I was concerned, because like anything else, I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of nervous, but it came out all right at the end. Another time that was frightening to me in this regard was because I was, when I say I don't mean me from a personal standpoint, my company that I had started in my practice, the bonding kind of named, it was a company named Reliable Bail Bond Company, because we continued to make the bonds and the others discontinued making bonds for the demonstrators, began to harass me on those bases. And I received a phone call with a threat of death, and I had to make some adjustments in my home arrangements because I was afraid I was going to be bombed. I, along with several other people there, lawyers and friends, were threatened, and we did have guards for a period of time around our street in order to, yes, I guess, be constable. And I was asked one time, was I afraid? Yes, I must say so. But within me, I wasn't violent, and we took that as a firm desire to carry out what Dr. King wanted. The whole movement, nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall one time we had a young man who also became a lawyer that we wanted to integrate the restaurant in the Five and Dime stores. And the main thing that he would say, what he would do, be sure I can get out of jail. That's the main thing everybody wanted. And he, along with two or three other of his pals, would go to a five and dime store, sit at the white counter, make an order, and when they call the police, he would see the police and run.
Mm.
And it was fun to him because he told me they'll never catch him. And he said, dude, I'm going to get out of jail because they'll make my bond. Well, they began to feel comfortable because the main thing was, will I get out of jail and who will get me out of jail?
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to a point that first it did get out that we were not going to be able to make everybody jail so they don't go to jail. But when it came out to the fact that it could be done, and in spite of my name maybe, it was a comfort when they would say that Dr. Paul Bates would get you out of jail. And the word spread it, that don't worry, he'll get you out of jail. So I became the man who get you out of jail. Then some of the mothers used to call my home or call the church and say, are you going to get folks out of jail? If I said, yeah, that was it. We had that kind of relationship because the movement and the desire in Birmingham as compared to other places, because of the structure of the government body there in Birmingham, there was total resentment for the government body because one man was in charge, one commissioner was in charge of the police department.
Hmm.
And consequently, the police deal with his name was Bull Connor.
Bull Connor, right.
Mm-hmm. Bull Connor ruled the city because he had the police department. And therefore, this is how things started fighting back at him and trying to beat him at his own game. And consequently, it drew people into the movement, particularly when they learned that if I go to jail, I might stay 2 days or 3 days, but I know I'm going to get out because they can make my bond.
Mm-hmm.
That made people happy to participate, happy to go in and join the cause. Of course, there were those who did not want to, like we mentioned in the group that wrote Dr. King. Those five preachers at their audience and their followers. And that made it hard for the community, particularly those persons who worked in domestic work.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to work, so consequently, will I have a job? But what happened, These are things that happen undercover that you never know, but will tell you. In Birmingham, like in other cities, many of the wealthy people who did give employment to our people, the different rich people, shall we say, used them, and many of those people had to be at work, and all that the judges and the lawyers and et cetera could go to their office, get them time to take care of the children. So they came, and they, what they used to do, they would send a community bus down to one of the local stores or and pick the people up to take them up on the mountains, as they called it. And this bus would come down and might pick up 25 people. To take to the neighborhood, to drop them off, to go to the different homes in order for the owners to turn their children over to while they go to work. So if somebody came up with the idea, we would just miss the bus. And don't go over on the mountains to work. Well, that created a problem then for the people who were looking for the domestics to come.
Mm-hmm.
To take care of our children. It was those kind of things, as you might call it, not publicly known, but were a part of the movement.
And a very important part, that's the thing, because, you know, for the longest, people of color, particularly African Americans, have been the working force for this country. So during the Civil Rights Movement in Birmingham, as you're explaining now, and people really, we heard that about the bus boycott when people just chose not to take the bus, and it crippled the city economically. But in terms of what you're saying, how people just boycotted and didn't take that bus that would drop them off at these wealthy homes, Caucasian homes, how
they
chose not to do it.
And they began to ask, can we find some form of being able to get some of this release out of the way? And consequently, sometimes it happened, but it worked. And then, of course, in Birmingham, they finally changed the form of government from a commission form to a council form.
Mm-hmm.
And that was able to allow a different type of political acceptance, because those persons were on council. That's when the African Americans began to be elected to office, and that changed things too. But then again, that came about after the movement things began to die down. And many of the whites began to help the efforts to get things quieted down for their children's sake. And we took advantage of it when we could. There were many things that perhaps one day I'd write a book on. But
also fascinating. This is so fascinating. So I'm fascinated with the behind-the-scenes part, like I said, because we see the movies that chronicle Dr. King's life, which are very, very important. And we see the bombing of the church, you know, in Birmingham with the four little girls that were killed. So, and we see Dr. King in jail writing the letter from a Birmingham jail. We see people being hosed and the dogs being sicked on them by Bull Connor, you know, which was just really inhumane and just really unfathomable. But he did it. And we see those things. But the behind-the-scenes information that you're now giving us, no one knows this. And I think it's so important. It's a part of our African-American history, and it's a part of the American history, so people can understand that it just didn't happen, because people just think that Dr. King just woke up one day and decided to do this. Everything was planned out. You know, people tend to want to think that we as African Americans are reckless, and we don't think things out. We're emotion driven, when in fact that is we're no more emotion driven than any other group. But that's the stereotype that the media likes to perpetuate when it comes to us. So I think that it's really, really important, and I'm just so appreciative that you're taking this time to clarify some things and give us the information that was not part of the story, and which was very important, because without your bailing, and like you said, you did 1,400 bonds, without that, there wouldn't have been a movement, because people would have still been in jail. So, and people don't really think about that or have that information. So, please continue.
No, I think it's good that they get that. My thing is, Professor, that we need education.
Right.
And this program that you have now is educational.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk broadly, and people sometimes go out and they don't always get an understanding, and they make statements. But when you learn more and more, it's to your advantage, because you can carry it forward. You can see the struggle in a different way. It's all
exactly.
Right to say that you went to the bus station, or you went downtown and you want to go to the restroom, they had a restroom in the back of the the word said covered, but then when you walk away, you saw the cover signs, you thought no more about it, some people. But when you look at the fact and say that when you got to the bathroom, it was in the back of the store, the door was locked.
Mm.
And you had no other place to go. That's the part that's important, not because the door was locked. Like when we were going through this very thing here in Birmingham, when you catch the trolley, I use the word trolley, some folks use streetcar. When you get, in some case, when you get ready to go and catch a streetcar, if the streetcar stands up there to be loaded, and there were whites and African Americans standing there to load the streetcar, the system was that the white person catches the bus first, man and woman, catch the streetcar. And when all of the whites were on, then the blacks would come on. But now, if there were not enough seats, and they had moved the sign back as far as they could move it for blacks, then they tell you, catch the next car.
Mm.
If it's raining, you get wet. Those type of things that you look at for a period of time and you say, I just can't take this any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can give many, many, many examples of how I have had to encounter over a period of years discrimination. And it boils you up inside.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you react sooner or later. Mm-hmm. I've had many people to ask me, how did you get involved in this? How can you set you on TV? And they call the station and tell them if they let me go on, they're going to bomb the station.
Mm.
They came to me and said, we just got a bomb. They said, if they let you go on today, this station will be bombed and your car will be bombed.
Wow.
And then they asked me, what should we do? I said, I can't tell you all what to do, but I'll tell you one thing. I came to broadcast.
Wow.
And I went on, and they said, well, okay. They called the police and all that. But the main thing is, I'm saying, it is those type of things that make you react the way you react.
Mm-hmm.
And when they say nonviolent, that's the part that you really got to live with. Because
mm-hmm.
you're taking a position that I'm not going to fight back in a violent way.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what brought about many of the activities that we had, specifically in Birmingham, because it was being almost promoted by the whites who thought that they could win. And in my opinion, the thing that brought about the real change was when we began to say that all these bond out people are demanding a jury trial
mm-hmm.
for that case and the jailing of those children. Those two things began to bring about a lot of attention in a different fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are reading about it, they'll see about it, they'll know about it, and some just read about it and turn their head. But when those things start surfacing, it created a different attitude among some of those in the community who wanted to see those kids out to get put in jail and dogs biting at them. I'm talking about some of the blacks, because there were many people who did think that we were going too far.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about African Americans. There are a lot of them who thought.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I think that that's really important, too, because there were a lot who were conservative. One in particular, Thurgood Marshall, was not in support of any of the protest movements. He felt that the way to really acquire justice was through the court system and that everything needed to be adjudicated, but that sit-ins and protest movements, he was not fond of that. So people think, Now, it's interesting that Dr. King is no longer here. Everybody, African American, Caucasian, everybody, oh, he was my best friend. I was supportive of him. It was the complete opposite. A lot of middle class black folk were not in support of Dr. King. They felt that he was rocking the boat and that change would come, but he was rocking the boat and trying to make change happen too quickly, and all the people connected with him. So now it's very interesting. It's just the same with our present president. All the ridicule and all of the hatred that he's encountering, those same people 20 years from now, oh, I knew Barack and I was supportive of him. It's interesting how they rewrite history, because because his history is going to be rewritten too. The people, young people who are not now born, would think that everybody, especially the Republicans, were pro him, because they're going to rewrite history. They like to be on the winning side. So what happens is that people of all races, you know, who were not supportive of Dr. King, African Americans, and as well as Caucasians, as well as other people who were not in support of him, now are singing "We Shall Overcome" and claiming that they were his best friend. I said, I know he must be turning over in his grave, because that was far from being the truth. You know, most of the ones who were supportive are the people like you and who took a stand, and there were some silent supporters too who maybe didn't march, but they sent their money in to support his cause, and they did what they could. But it's interesting, all these people who were definitely not pro-King and are claiming that they were his best friends. So I said, this man probably said, you know, on the other side, I had 1,001 best friends. Because everyone's claiming that they were his best friends. And that's not the case.
You see, Dr. King, and if you had really sat down and listened to him and talked to him, very evenly, very well-liked person, and when it comes down to the laws of the country, he in a sense says, apply the laws. And you have the law on the book. If they were wrong, you say so. He said, but if it's unjust, it's not a law.
Right.
See, if it is an unjust law, that's not a law. And it's true. If there's an unjust law, now you got justice all over this country, but don't put up there and say you can ride the bus, shall we say. Be careful. Everybody going to have a nice time, in a sense. But in the meantime, but wait just a moment. That group back here can't ride the bus and have a good time. The law says you can ride, but then there's one who says, but. Then that's unjust. If it's a just law, obey it and move forward. And if you read, I guess you've seen his letter from the Birmingham jail. If not, get it one day and read it.
Yes.
At the library, I'm sure.
I've read it. It's powerful.
Okay,
it's
okay,
so
you're right. If
yes.
Many of your listeners would get that letter and read it and digest it, it's magnificent. It gives you a complete and a real true understanding of that man. Not because of what he has achieved, but the letter itself explains. As a matter of fact, the letter says, going about his work, he called not his activities in a sense of trying to be a hero, but this is my calling. This is my work. Let me carry out my work. That's all he was saying, in a nonviolent way. And if you pick that up and carry it forward. I spoke at the University of Wisconsin, I think it was one place I spoke anyway, and there was a question and answer section, and there was a young man, he was some foreign country, wasn't in the black holiday anyway, and he stood up, and each time he stands to ask a question or say something, he immediately would sit back down. And he did this about 4 or 5 times, and the moderator wouldn't ever call on him because he wasn't standing long enough. So then I, in turn, said to her, there's a man back there in the back, he keeps standing, sitting, standing and sitting. Maybe he asked somebody, he'd like to ask me a question or whatever it is. And the fellow stood up and looked like for about 10 or 15 seconds, wouldn't say a word. Then he dropped his head and he said something that is worth thinking about. He was saying, Dr. King's activities and your activities and the other people who go around with these type of activities had to happen in this life in order for us to be where we are today. Mm-hmm. Had these things not happened, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
At that, I was looking for a strong type argument in his explanation, but he sat down. Then my mind said, when does he have something else he wants to say? But later on, I received a compliment from the professor there, told me that he had written his dissertatory on things that I had said, and the school is awarding him. So he started then in the movement himself on the school campus.
Wow. So
those things happen. Yes, they had to happen, and I believe there would be another movement. I might be gone. Now, when I say movement, I'm not like some people. We've had a movement all along. But in the movement that we were talking about back in 63, back in those days, they were movements for discrimination and things of that nature. But there, in my estimation, would be a day when some group will take the Constitution of the United States of America and begin then to less amend it if necessary or apply by what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you will have to worry about some of the discrimination we get in schools. People not getting jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So what mm-hmm. you're doing now, as I said in the beginning, is for people to admit their limitations, admit how little they know about the things they think they know.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that statement. Admit how little you know about things you think you know. Then seek good teaching. Think about that.
That's very true.
Very, very true.
That's very, very true.
Yeah. Okay, is there any other questions for me? Yeah.
I'm just sitting at your feet, metaphorically listening. Because I have some people on the board, but I would ask again to press 1. The number is 1-818-572-8023, and press 1. And to ask any questions about the movement of Reverend Paul Banks, who has given us excellent information, behind-the-scenes information about what really happened during the Civil Rights Movement in Birmingham, Alabama, as well as in Selma, because he was there. This is not a second or third-hand account. This is a first-person account. He was actually there, being actively involved in the movement. So please feel free to call us if you have any questions at 818-572-8023 and press 1. Reverend Banks, we have about 27 minutes more, so please continue to share, because I see people who are on the board, but obviously they just want to listen, which is a good thing. That happens with me as well. They want to just hear your story, because they've not heard this information before.
All right. Well, let's go back to the bonding, because, again, is what I feel one of the things that we can't ignore, because there were people arrested all over the country, and somebody had to bond them out. The cases came. Now, back to the bonding case, many of our people who were jailed and began to seek advancements in their road of life, some employment and other things, and there became the question as to, in the application process, what the question was, have you ever been arrested?
Mm-hmm.
And many didn't consider that as an arrest in the true sense. And from the legal process, again, the answer is debatable, because you've got to go for definition from a legal standpoint. But however, I have many of them have gotten in touch with me and have called me and asked me, were they arrested in the sense of the arrest? When was it? What was my charge? Because they didn't. The thing was, in being arrested, it was no concern of those persons when they were in the process of enrolling to be arrested and are being arrested and confined to jail for any period of time and bailed out. They didn't look at it as being an arrest that would go against their record for the rest mm-hmm. of their lives. Now, there became then a definition in respect to whether or not I'm arrested, then was it ever adjudicated? Meaning, if you were arrested, what became of the case? What became mm-hmm. of my case was, I never went back to court anymore. I was not found guilty or non-guilty. And that hangs with many people today. However, because the cases are all dismissed with throughout the governmental proceedings, they're still there. And many of them, when they get to that point, they say, yeah. And if they aren't careful, with no true understanding or an explanation, they figure that they went against them for being arrested for civil rights activities. And it stands today, because they don't think and get enough information to be able to give an explanation as to whether or not that arrest went against me. Because I said yes, or I didn't answer and they questioned me and I could not give, those things are still standing. And they will stand as far as it goes in respect to that particular answer. What I'm saying is, it is these kind of things that are part of the total proceedings pertaining to the movement, as you are things pertaining there too. And I don't necessarily like the word movement, because we've been making movements ever since I've been born.
Yeah.
If you look at it from the word just movement, but it's there, and those persons who participated and have these concerns, you can see again the underground things, or not necessarily underground, the backroom things that come forward that you will never know unless you have these type of programs where people can learn and gather information that will help them to know more about their own surroundings. I think I'm making myself clear.
No, it's very, very clear, very clear. So with some of those persons who were arrested, who now have this on their record, just having for something that's harmless, like a protest movement, has that blocked them from employment?
No, you never know. I never know the results of what happens when I have been called and asked about the arrest. and having to explain, in a sense, you were arrested. And mainly what they're concerned with is if I answer yes and the application then allow me to detail why, or unless they attach something to it, to explain why it's just hanging out there. And they want to know. Now, I don't know whether or not they have not or not been employed because of the question and the manner in which they have to answer. I don't know what effect it had on the employment proceedings at all. But I do know I have received people, calls from people who asked me because they did not understand it to a point that maybe at some day that this question might appear on an application that I'm interested in, and I have to answer yes, because when some people look at arrest, some employers, immediately they draw a conclusion about the applicant.
Exactly.
And I don't allow them to detail it, but it's still hanging there. And this program like this, one might be hearing it, and later on down the line, if they had been involved in an arrest of this nature, they would have heard this portion and probably draw a conclusion or go to their employee, prospective employee, with an explanation as to why I was arrested or why I'm answering this. Put a attachment to the application.
But two people,
I've been asked more than once about that.
Well, two people whom I know who are now very famous who have been arrested, well, several people, and it has not affected their careers have been Congressman John Lewis, who's a congressman now for Georgia, and Reverend Jesse Jackson. You know, Congressman Lewis has been involved in politics for a long period of time, so even though he was arrested, it didn't affect his career because he was viewed as a civil rights icon. The same thing for Reverend Jesse Jackson. And I think some of the people who were more famous just started their own organizations and then were brought in by corporations to be consultants. So, but for the people who are not as famous, it'll be interesting to find out how it affected them. Because
and
other
those
people,
are the ones that I was involved with, and many of them I didn't know them and still don't know them individually, only to a point of having to deal with them versus the arrest for the demonstration. I wouldn't know them because of the matter of seeing them and at the movement meetings and making an appeal bond for them or an appearance bond. Those are two different bonds. And when that's over with, they're gone. And they were never called back to court. So I never see them anymore. And one would have called me, and when they have called me, I didn't know who I was talking to, only trying to give an answer that they could live with, and if a yes or no answer, not to give them an answer that would throw them off, you have to tell them that they were arrested. And hopefully they carry it forward to the extent that it was a civil affair and it was in connection with demonstrations. And the employer, and most of them wouldn't care, but there are some who might have resentment and consequently may not hire them for that purpose. But they should not be discriminated against on those bases, because to me that would be discrimination.
Right.
Again, what I'm saying is, we're speaking of the Thoreau movement, the effect, etc., and we're talking about those things that are not necessarily brought to front. And when they are brought to front, what are the answers? And first, why is it as it was and being brought to the front. But when you learn about it, when you learn about the fact how those persons who participated into the movement anywhere in the country, how they first got involved in it, how they agreed to put their time in it, those who were arrested, felt when they were arrested and came out. Now, what we did in Birmingham, when you would get one out of jail for demonstrations purposes, make the appearance bond for them. Then when they come out, we put them in a car, take them downstairs and downtown, rather, excuse me, and we would give them a meal. Mm. And after the meal is over with, they would go to their respective homes, those who want to the meal, sit down and talk for a while. And that was the end of it, something they never saw again.
Mm-hmm.
And never would ever see them again. But the arrest record was still there. So I think at this point, though, those who have to answer that question, that's a long time ago, 50 years now to be exact. If they're working, they're working and probably have retired too.
Right.
But yet, those things happened, and that was part of the movement. That,
right.
That wasn't even thought when we were going through the process.
Mm.
But it does have an effect on some people when they see that, and some people don't care. I recall one time I went to the to get a person out of jail, and by coincidence, and I don't know why, she was in jail, and they were processing her through some kind of means to a jail cell or whatever, and she looked and she saw me very joyfully while she was in jail. In fact, I think that was her third time.
Oh,
and,
wow.
She says, oh, I'm glad to see you. I said, what's wrong? She said, look at me. You don't see a scratch on me, do you? I said, no. She said, look at me real good now. Look at my face. You don't see a scratch. Now, when I go in the jail and come out, I better come out with no scratches on me. She said, oh, hear that, Mr. Jailer? He said, well, I mean, that was fun to them. To them, that's what, but I mean, being in jail would mean nothing to her if she had to see it on a piece of paper. She'd be glad to say, yes, I went for discrimination purposes and be proud of it. And then the others who, when they look at it afterwards, do have some thoughts about it because that question is still there and will be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different things about the bonding that I think should be made known. And also, because I could go through many, many, many more incidents that would just bore people, the incidents of it that were not that significant as far as police and the people were concerned. But it was from the standpoint of at that time, because it was concerning to the people in Birmingham, all over the country for that concern.
Mm-hmm. But did you have more women than men, or an equal, more men than women, males or females, or was it an equal ratio, do you know?
With regards to
going to jail.
Yeah,
people who were involved in the protest marches who ended up being
more
jailed.
Women. Far more women.
Far more women?
Yeah, women.
Oh,
they get their friends and get together at a club meeting and discuss it. And then say, let's go down and volunteer. Some who are not at all a part of the Alabama Christian Movement, that was the organization. See, that was a local organization in every city. I think the reading is that there were some 80 or more local organizations that were affiliated with Dr. King's and the SCLC movement. when I see a filler, he'd go by and they call him and send a speaker or let him get whatever they need in order to keep them involved. But he was not directly involved because he was indirectly involved because they, again, when they start calling him an outsider, they were trying to say that you're an outsider. You have no reason to participate into anything like this in this town or any other town. But the facts were that he was invited to come to Birmingham to help the local organization, which was not very strong, but met and kept on meeting. And when he was invited, that created the picture that allowed him to participate. And then they began to, in a sense, lead us and help us.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that came about, how his involvement was into it and how his own enthusiasm and his commitment allowed those persons who began to become committed, but they were women. They were not, men were there, and men were the background, and the backbone of it, local. Then you had the other meetings, and the things that happened, even when SCLC had its problems in Alabama and other parts of the country, they attempted, what they did in Alabama, they began to tell SCLC that you are a foreign corporation and you have no business operating in Alabama. You have no permit to operate here because it was a local, then it became a local thing. But there again, you had women, and you can name many local women almost in any town that is out front leading. In many of the cases, are very well involved with the leadership of the local groups as they continue to perform their activities on a local basis. So, to answer your question, as far as bonding is concerned, we had far more females. Than males.
Wow.
Yeah, far more.
And you don't get that sense when you look at the documentaries. You see a lot of men, and you don't really get the sense that there were more women than men. At least I
did. Well, no, you don't, because you as a man are louder, number one, and men are more forceful. Men are braver, and they can confront matters in a stronger way than women, and in many instances, they are heard louder than the men. Once in a while, you find a strong woman back in those days when you got ready to fight, say, the desire to go to the lunchroom counters and eat in Mississippi and Alabama, different places. You have in the five and dime stores, you would have a lunchroom counter. And at the lunchroom counter, you have a long space with seats more or less for whites and blacks standing up there, but it wasn't uncommon to see a woman, black woman, go in those, one of those places and stand up because most of the time she's talking to another woman who might be the man. And she can be heard, but see, men, the voice is a little bit stronger. The voice of a man. I gave a sermon on that one time. The voice of a man. And it is true. The man's voice is heard and they recognize it. I'm not going to say that they aren't as forceful or effective. But even the young people, the young girls and boys who participated in being jailed pulled their buddies into their affairs, but they were young ladies in most instances.
Well, you have shed a light onto this movement that we're not aware of at all. In the last remaining 6 minutes, how do you think? It's a rhetorical question, but I just want to know what do you think Dr. King would say if he were alive and to see President Obama reelected for the second time?
I think that he would say, not in a dream fashion as that, I think that he would say that he felt that the day was coming when a black person, man or woman, would be the president of the United States. And I think he would say it, he felt that it would be done in his lifetime.
Mm.
That's the way I feel. Because his approach was, in effect, the present effect of what's happening around us. And in order for it to be effective for what's happening around us more and more and more, it has to be a present situation. And for it to be a present situation in respect to what we say, when you say you can be anything, then anything means right now. So I feel that he would, in his true heart, say that he felt that they would come in his lifetime that a black person would be the president of the United States.
And that's just so remarkable because he was a visionary. And
yeah.
I think that he could see, when he said, I've been to the mountaintop, which means when you're at the mountaintop, you oversee things. You're at a higher elevation than those of us who are in the valley. When we're in the valley, we can't see what the visionary who's on the mountain can see. And I think that he was a true visionary. I think that he, along with some other icons within our history, laid the foundation for us to take it to the next level, because people like Fannie Lou Hamer, who is an unsung heroine of the black movement, she was involved with the voters in Mississippi, and it's because of her that we have black delegates, you know, that go to when they have these conventions. That was due to her efforts. So there are a lot of unsung heroes and heroines that I'm going to talk about of who are African American, who are Latino, who are Asian, who are women, just a lot of people that we need to know more about and really understand that but for them we would not be where we are. And I'm just so thankful and appreciative of you, because but for your bonding company of bailing out 1,400 people, the movement would have come to a standstill. It would have had to. So I would like to take this time to thank you. I have 60 seconds left to thank you on behalf of everyone listening in the audience. I know that they share my sentiment that we're so appreciative of you, Reverend Banks, and so thankful to you and your efforts and your commitment to the movement and your continuous involvement and commitment to the movement. And I'm so honored to have your lovely wife, Cynthia, and you as my neighbors. And thank you so very, very, very much. And for the listening audience, next week, we're going to have the Near Death Experience Part 2. And we have 3 speakers for next week. And so the person you heard this evening was Reverend Paul Banks, who is now a retired lawyer and activists. So we bid you farewell and have a great week, and thank you for joining us and listening. Take care until next week.
from my mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional body. 'Cause I know that spirit guides me, and love lives inside me. That's why